out of Fort Worth, Texas. That's the great King Curtis with a little something to help you free your mind. It's his famous Soul Serenade. Born Curtis Owsley, King Curtis did it all. Jazz, soul, soul jazz, rock and roll, R&B, funk and blues as a band leader, a band member, session man, and musical director, and record producer. King Curtis was the victim, however, of a homicide in New York City on August the 13th, 1971. He was just 37 years old. Soul Serenade, which was released as a hit single in 1964, was played at his funeral as mourners filed in. Funeral was officiated by Jesse Jackson and drew a who's who in the music world. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, August the 14th, and as you know, it is time to free your mind. Lots to talk about, I'm sure. 888-874-4888. Keep it nice and tight, and let's get started. Hello, Harvey. You're on the air from California.
Hello, more than wonderful, Eutrice.
Harvey, how are you doing today?
Wonderful. Well, the way things are going, I was thinking of opening an out-of-body shop. So, but since so much comes through our voting, the change comes through voting, I'd like to talk about the 2016 vote. And I believe that with the voting machines, you know, many of them are Republican manufactured, and they have what is known as proprietary software, that secret software that they don't have to disclose to the public. And I heard programs where these voting machines can be, the numbers can be flipped from a guy sitting outside with a computer or laptop. And if that's not bad enough, I haven't heard this referenced in the news, but, you know, there's the headline says here, limited safety from data breach. And it turns out that these data thieves, they don't just steal, they're not interested in stealing your password and all that. They steal corporate. They go corporate. They steal millions all at once of names, card numbers, everything, you know, and information on us. And I'm afraid that these guys might steal the 2016 vote. And who knows, maybe they'll sell it to the highest bid. I don't know. It's all vulnerable out there. And I feel that we have to go back to paper with a receipt and secure, you know, recycled paper, of course, and secure our vote once again. Not that paper votes are perfect, but at least they give us a chance. This, the way the computer voting is now, especially with data breach, it's too vulnerable. So I'm calling for back to paper voting, and with a receipt.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You got us started today.
Thank you.
From New York, Mart, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Good afternoon.
A point of clarification. I miss who the artist was on Soul Serenade.
Oh, that's King Curtis.
Oh, excellent. And I want to bring us back, especially in front of CNN and MSNBC, who had some surprisingly brilliant coverage on what is happening in Ferguson. I think we need to have some energetic discussion around this a so-called war on terror. I have not heard anybody connecting what has happened in Gaza and to Gaza and continuing that this whole idea of the militarization of police and the war on terror is a fraud, because you don't let Israel savage the civilians and innocents of Gaza and tell us that they're protecting us from or concerned about terrorism, because that just would be creating terrorists. I also want to ask you to please bring Brother Alton back for a session, whether it's a Friday or another day, where we can engage him, because I think a lot of things will come out, especially with the so-called progressive de Blasio administration, so that we can we can engage him around the discussion. I'd also like your comments on, I recently saw on the HBO documentary channel, a documentary called the Newburgh Sting. And it shows how the FBI went into Newburgh, New York, and set up some brothers who basically didn't have a plug nickel, and some of them were probably developmentally disabled in many ways, and how then they made it a big deal before Congress about how we prevented this great terrorist event in the Bronx, Riverdale, against synagogues, when it was the whole idea and even coercion of their informant to affect the sting and the scam. And I'll listen to your responses to my concerns over the air if I can.
Well, thank you. The sting, the Newburgh sting, was about the FBI essentially coordinating a conspiracy and cooking up a conspiracy in order to have a public case that the Al-Qaeda elements and terrorist elements, mostly Muslim elements, were working and creating cells in New York City. It happened that they centered this particular effort at a mosque in Riverdale. In Newburgh, New York, of course. And they were supposed to be attacking a synagogue in Riverdale. The FBI informant, the FBI person that they used to coordinate this whole thing, himself was a questionable figure, a Pakistani operative, still with a lot of unanswered questions in his background. But in effect, they secured the conviction of these four men, and it is a case of it illustrates how very often the government is basically running renegade movements, renegade operations within black communities, and single out black communities, in fact, that are politically unprotected to do these kinds of things. It's worth looking at. It was a very, very informative documentary. With regard to Alton, he will make several return appearances because there are issues based on the experiences that we are having lately that he's uniquely situated to discuss. So he'll be back. So thank you so much for your call, Maat. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air. Hello, how are you today?
Utrece, I am doing great, Utrece, and greetings to the PRN audience, and I'll start off by wishing you an enjoyable weekend.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Utrece, to answer the question that Harvey posed, what he should do is watch that documentary. It's online. It's called American Blackout, and it told you about the stealing of the election. This is not something that's going to happen in 2016. This stuff has been going on ever since electronic voting was introduced. So if you could pull up that documentary, and anyone else for that matter, pull up that documentary, it detailed what happened with Cynthia McKinney in the 4th Congressional District in Georgia, as well as Max Cleland, who was a senator, who was electronic balloting, was used, rigged machine, was used to get them out of office. Also, your last caller just got offline, and she was speaking about the entrapment that is being done by the NYPD as well as the FBI. Al Jazeera have a documentary. It's also online. It's called Informant. And it details exactly what happened in Newburgh as well as what happened with the Willis/Sears Tower in New York and with those Miami people who were blacks and the Muslims who were also entrapped by the FBI and using that sting operation to put them away. So, you know, these are things that you can look out at. It's called Informant, and you can pull that up online through Al Jazeera. But to get back off of what I wanted to free my mind on, Utrece, really quick, I was watching this fiasco just now, well, a couple hours ago, where they released the name of this police officer who was involved in this killing of this young child. And at the same time they released this person's name, they also released some images to show that this child was involved in some alleged theft of some cigarillos at a convenience store, and that's why he was being stopped by the cop. This information never came out before. This is the first time, you know, all of a sudden now, you're smearing this child in his death, trying him in the public arena by releasing these images about 6 days after he was killed in order to obscure this killer cop's information, to bury it in the news. And all the focus, once again, is going to be put back onto this child as being responsible for his own death. This is where the media, as I said, once again, this media is very complicit, and all of these so-called liberals, progressives, and all of these others who always like to jump on this and saying that, because I watched that governor. The governor is a Democrat. Who is Nixon in Missouri? He's a Democrat. So is Knowles, who is the mayor for Ferguson. They're all Democrats, as well as you have Claire McCaskill, who is a Democratic junior senator from Missouri. Lacey Clay, all of them are Democrats. So when people like to go and play this left-right paradigm of, you know, the Republicans are the bad guys and the Democrats are not, I keep putting y'all back to remember that the Democrats are in bed with this, because that hemming and hawing that governor was doing when he snatched up this black state trooper and threw him into the fray, because he looks black like us, like they always do, the same way they did with Barack Obama. They snatch a black man and put him out there because black people are going to get distracted with symbolism, and we're going to calm down, and we're going to forget what our issue is, because we're going to be so glad we got a brother in charge. We are being played for a fool, and with Sharpton, Crump, and now this brother who's allowed himself to be used into this mess here to circumvent it, because they didn't mention that this child was a thief. They didn't say nothing but he's stealing anything in the store. This could all be an accusation, because we know you're going to these stores, and if you're black, you always be walked around and be followed just to assume that you're in there to steal.
They said it, this wasn't just the accusation of theft. This was, they've said that he was the, quote, prime suspect, unquote, in a, quote, strong-arm robbery.
Exactly.
Of a convenience store. So,
exactly.
You know, the ante is being upped, in other words. That's for sure.
It's being upped, not only that, Utrecht, but what they're showing, they're looping this video over and over again to show this child, you know, this big, big child, you know, big black child, this little skinny, short little man, store owner or whatever, clerk or whatever, and the man tried to close the door to stop him from leaving, and he pushed the man off, and, you know, and he walked out the store. When these cops had never said anything whatsoever about when they stopped him, that it was because he was a suspect. All that they said over and over again, he was in the street, he was jaywalking, he was walking down the middle of the street, the cop pulled up next to him and told him, you need to get off the street. He didn't tell him nothing about, okay, I need to get some ID from you because you've been accused of being in some sort of illegalities. So this media, once again, they are burying this person's information, giving them some time to get his story together, this killer cop, while the focus is being shifted on this child. And I'm hearing people are talking, saying, but it's not about race. And if I hear that one more time, you, Teresa, I'm going to scream real loud, because it is about race.
It is about race. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because, of course, we'll be discussing how this is unfolding and what the public is being allowed to know and when, and the whole choreography of it. We'll be getting into it, but it's good that you're keeping tabs. Thanks so much for your call today. From New York, Joel, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrecht. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm very fine. Utrecht, about a little more than a week ago, I recall that you had Richard Falk on your program. Very
yes.
Interesting program where he sort of set the historical record straight in part of an address that you read. And, of course, Falk is known for his work in relating international relations to the question of international morality. And as an officer for the New York, for the United Nations, he has, has done this, of course, from a number of years in Israel and Palestine, and has earned the unending vilification from the Israeli government and Israeli media people. I listened to his comments and was quite moved by them. And I began thinking about the nature of the crimes that were committed. But even more, I began to become interested in the perpetrators of these war crimes and how extensive the responsibility is, that it goes beyond Israel, and there are international accomplices. So I thought I would briefly mention those who I think deserve to be held responsible for this tragedy that has taken place over the last month. And the first group, I think, are the Israeli Defense Forces themselves, not just the brass, not just the high officer corps. We have lots of evidence that showed that it wasn't just military strategists and policymakers that need to be held responsible, but also ordinary soldiers. There's eyewitness testimony, documentation showing that middle and lower rank soldiers engaged in wanton shootings of school children, shoppers, mothers with babies fleeing combat zones. So war crimes prosecutions cannot be, in my judgment, confined merely to a few dozen senior officers. These crimes were committed at all levels of the armed service. Then, of course, there are the political leaders and the policymakers, starting with Netanyahu and his cabinet, who are prime movers in launching the blitz against Gaza. And they justified the massive civilian killings. Clearly, they should be at the center of any kind of international war crimes tribunal. But what about the Israeli public, the great mass of Israeli Jews who view themselves, as I see them, as morally above world public opinion, despite a near universal revulsion of these crimes? More than 90% of Israeli Jews, in every poll that I've seen, gave unstinting support to the ongoing bloodbath, knowing, in fact, even cheering daily from grandstands erected on hills overlooking Gaza. They are also an essential part of this criminal enterprise. They celebrated the carnage. They violently attacked the few Israelis who openly questioned the war. So they have no claim to innocent ignorance. And they can't call this a tragic conflict between two peoples. And no Israeli can absolve himself or herself by claiming ignorance of the nature of the crimes that were committed in their name, just as Germans couldn't in the 1940s. What about the moralists, the famous chief rabbis, who seem to have no qualms in piously urging on this mass slaughter? Is there a high court of religious authority where these holy men can be held accountable for their incitement of war crimes? What about the worldwide network of international Zionist organizations who secured billions of dollars of the murderous arms shipments from a corrupt and craven U.S. Congress and executive? Are they not accomplices? And finally, what about all of those organizations, Zionist organizations in Britain, France, and in America, who organize multi-million-dollar fundraisers at, for instance, in New York at the luxurious Waldorf, where Republican and Democratic elected leaders pledged to give an additional, what was it, $225 million so that missiles and tanks could be sent to Israel to resupply its arsenal, which were used in razing thousands of homes and obliterating entire families? So I think that we need to start talking about this now and talking about it openly. And, of course, we probably won't see all of these people brought up before the dock of the International Criminal Court. But if you remember, during the Vietnam War, we had an International War Crimes Tribunal in Stockholm. And it was, of course, vilified by the Americans. I remember Dean Rusk attacking Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher who was about 100 years old then, who ran the thing. And I remember, I'll never forget it, John Paul Sartre sneering back at Rusk and saying, you're dealing with, you know, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, 20s concerned about peace, and you're nothing but a mediocre functionary. So I think even if we can't get it before the ICC, I think these crimes need to be expressed openly in the public. And I think those who are responsible, and it is a wide swath of people, need to be pointed out for their terrible crimes. And just one last thing, if I may. The question arises, what unites all these people in this horrible undertaking? And I think that Israel is in the grip of a kind of collective schizophrenia. Not only do its politicians and elitists, but even the Jewish population seem to have delusions of both grandeur and persecution. Now, persecution was real, but a persecution complex can be built on reality so that it becomes an exacerbation of reality. And when you mix grandiosity with persecution in an individual, it's explosive. Imagine what happens when you mix it in the national character.
Thank you, Joel, for your very considered opinion today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
From Germany, Catherine, you're on the air.
Thanks very much, Nutrice. I'm calling to talk about the Christians in the Middle East. And My husband and I both work with Christian refugees here in the German-Dutch border, refugees that fled Turkey, southeast Turkey, from an area called Turabdin, which is about 100 kilometers or 75 miles north of where the Christians are now facing persecution in Iraq. And what I've noticed in the media is that when I listen to the American media, they're always talking about the Yazidis, which is, and they never mention the Christians, whereas the Christians are more than three times the number of the Yazidis that are having to flee the ISIS regime. And so I was talking with this about my husband, like, why aren't the Christians mentioned? Why is it always, why are they always talking about the Yazidis and other minorities, religious minorities, where the Christians, and we were saying, like, because no one can really relate to, can relate to the Yazidis. I mean, it sounds almost like an exotic bird or something that's going to go extinct. Like, you can't put a face on it. Whereas if the media were to emphasize the number of Christians that have been persecuted since 2003, 1 million Christians have had to leave Iraq or have been killed in Iraq. There were 1.5 million Christians living in Iraq alone, and now there are only 400,000. And they are under great, being persecuted now for their Christian beliefs.
If I were to understand what you've said, you seem to suggest that there's a value based on the number. And since the Christian population outnumbers the Yazidis, that it should be important to deal with the Christians and not so much with the Yazidis.
No, what I'm saying is that they're completely ignored. You never hear anything mentioned about them. And the fact that they've been asking for help since 2003, they've been asking for help. And since in the past year, they've been asking especially for help. They've seen this coming. And what I'm saying is not that anyone is of more value because of their belief system. What I'm saying is, what I notice, if you listen to the news, that the Christians are completely ignored. They're not really included in the headlines or in the newscast. The fact that there are this population in the Middle East where they originate from, and it's been going on since Ataturk in 1915. It's been happening in Turkey to the Syrian Orthodox Church. The millions of people were killed. Children were taken into the churches and massacred. People were thrown down wells. All of this has been happening since a long time, and suddenly it's of importance. And another thing I was talking to my husband about as well is, you know, the abuse of this situation, no matter whoever we're talking about now, but how the politicians first say, we're not sending any troops on the ground, and then they do send 150 people, soldiers, they send the planes, and then they say, well, it's really not as bad as we thought. We can pull out now. It's just a little scuffle. And when in fact this has been going on for years, and it's not, you know, if you talk with these people, it's really heartbreaking, and you see the damage it's done on generations after generations here in Europe where I live and I work with these people. And
well, I take your point. I think you have a good point about the fact that the Christian issue has not really received very much coverage, and I believe this is just my thought. I'm just conjecturing here. I have no evidence of anything at all, but I think it has to do with more geopolitical considerations than anything else, and where the United States sees its interests. Since the U.S. wants to basically help the Kurds against the onslaught of ISIS. And ISIS has taken on this as a primary objective in their current campaign. I think the United States has focused attention on that, and that means that the U.S. is going to be looking in the geographic area, to become involved in a geographic area where the Kurds and the Yazidis are. I also believe that it helps from a military perspective, that they would take a kind of position on the land occupied by the Yazidis in order to mount their military offensive against ISIS as it expands into the same territory where the Yazidis and the Kurds seem to have shared a certain geographic area. The issue with the Christians is really important. I mean, everybody is important.
They have also shared the land with the Christians. It's not just a Kurdish territory or an Yazidi territory. It's also a Christian territory, and that is completely ignored.
And I understand that, but I'm saying this is from a pure geopolitical consideration. It has nothing else to do with anything else. There's no logic to it. But that is the basis, I think, on which the United States, it has narrowed its interest. And, of course, the media, don't forget, the media in this case, they're embedded. The media are really serving the extension of U.S. objectives. And they are therefore concentrating on the primary areas of interest that the U.S. military and the U.S. government has. So they're not taking on anything outside of that.
Right, but it's not. I would argue that it's not outside. It's a part of, and it's always an ignored part of.
We agree. I don't disagree with you on that at all. I'm just saying this is how awful things could be, where in a particular situation where you should be able to see the broad picture, when people have very narrow military objectives, geopolitical objectives, everything else goes by the wayside. They're focusing on the land, getting the possession of the land. There is the dynamic that plays well, and that is that the Kurds, to whom the U.S. owes a great deal because they had actually abandoned the Kurds for a long time, and therefore the rise of ISIS is part of the U.S. abandonment of the Kurds. So they are basically, it's an all-out public relations campaign to say, well, we are fulfilling our commitment to the Kurds. And the Christians will just have to stand in line for help. Because right now, this is the military objective in that part of the world.
Well, I would say that the Christians get lost in the whole story and not seen in the whole story, and that their territory is as much it's as much their territory as the Kurds or the Israelis.
We don't disagree at all. Yeah. I agree exactly with what you say. But I'm just saying this is how it works out, you know. This is the awful nature of things.
The ISIS, like, nothing is being talked about. Like, where does ISIS get its weaponry? How they're selling oil that they've confiscated in on the international market. No one's talking about anything about ISIS and really the origins of it, and I find that very disturbing as well.
Well, a lot is being talked about it, except that, believe it or not, there is a hesitancy by major media especially to go out on a limb. Everybody's reading what it is they think the U.S. wants the media to do. And what the U.S. media wants, what the U.S. government wants the media to do is to basically help it in its campaign, to be part of its public relations campaign. And that means don't pay excessive attention to ISIS. Don't really put them too much in the headlines, except that the U.S. is gaining on them and the U.S. is containing them and so forth. The military objective is what is controlling the media's coverage right now in that corner of the world. Thanks so much, Catherine, for your call. From Virginia, Walter, you're on the air.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Based on what's going on out in Missouri, I got to thinking about the militarization of the police and the fact that many police officers are former military, either in infantry units or perhaps military police themselves, and then other police officers may have tried to get into the military and for various reasons couldn't get into the military. I kind of wondered where that mindset may have come from. I grew up on Marine Corps bases and quite frequently recall my father mentioning, various types of war stories of some of his fellow Marines. Let's just say going outside the call of military interaction in terms of rules and regulations. And, I'm sitting there as a child not really grasping all of what I was hearing. And now as an adult, it's kind of coming to fruition in terms of the mindset of a military individual or a person who has military tendencies, aspirations that would join the police force, which is a paramilitary organization. And there was a movie that came out a couple of years ago called Jack Reacher, and in that movie there was a quote, and that quote was, there are four types of people who join the military. For some, it's a family trade. Others are patriots, eager to serve. Next, you have those who just need a job. Then there's the kind who want the legal means of killing other people, unquote. And I think you have those same similar types that also join the police force. And that's all I just wanted to note.
Well, I think there are other types as well, because I know many of them. I know many, many police officers who really wanted to be on the police force because they have such a sense of pride in public service and wanting to do good. And they saw this as a calling, and they're very proud of the tradition of policing. They, of course, are increasingly in the minority, but I think I know many, many police officers of that mindset. They really take the job very seriously. They enjoy it, and they see it as a way of contributing to the safety and to the well-being of the community. What has happened, this militarization? I mean, I did a program, I just looked it up prior to the coming on air, on November the 21st last year about the militarization of police. And it was largely as a result of the leftover war and military equipment that are being recycled into local police departments. And of course, if you have military equipment, you're going to use it. And of course, if you also marry that with the notions of white supremacy in our country, where the policing in particular communities is an act of domination, a psychological expression of white might, then it is perfectly confluent with the use of military equipment. And it is perfectly confluent with the attitude and mindset that these communities are to be heavily managed with force, and because the people in these communities are really not people. So all these things get married into the notion of excessive use of force, and people take on that. It's translated from the leadership down. This is what we expect that should happen when these communities get out of hand, because the whole contest is in containing rage and containing conduct and behavior and containing people themselves, even their movements and whatnot. It becomes a very restrictive a kind of expression of latent desires to ultimately dominate, totally dominate another culture. That's really what it is. These communities are looked upon, I've likened it to petri dishes full of bacteria. And what you have to do is contain the bacteria. So you use very strong methods, both to send a message to those communities, but to also send a message to the other communities that, you know, you're serving their needs and their interests by proxy, by behaving this way as a police force in these communities.
Interesting. Thank you. Thanks for that, Patrice.
Thank you, Walter, for your call today. DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. A little depressed. I've got something on my mind. I just, looking at all this police murder that's going on, I think there's some real, real serious and deep soul searching that needs to go on in our communities, Black, Hispanic communities. So we need to get this thing under control. This is now again, like Sarah said, they're trying to smear this boy's name. And it's the same routine every time. We get outraged about it. We don't really examine what's really going on here. And there's a lot of issues, to be dealt with here. And there's a lot of work to be done. Every time something like this happens, it just makes me know how far off the mark we are. And I look back, you know, and I've researched things and looked back at like the 60s and the early 70s when all of our movements were co-opted and, or either the leaders killed. And I think that We had quite a few dynamics going on back then that we don't have going now. Now, I've always loved Dr. King and everything I've learned about him, and of course dig deeper than what we learned in high school or whatever, and found out a few other things about Dr. King and all that. And I've always loved his method of just being able to work with people, being nonviolent, you know, and things like that. It's very admirable. But we also had other dynamics going on at the same time. There was a threat of more militant type of activities by, of course, Black Panthers, and you had other people like Malcolm X that were preaching on a whole different side. And this, I believe, was what helped to get us the gains that we did make back then. Because now there's no threat either, because what they were saying to the power structure was either deal with this in this way, or you got to face it this way over here with these people. And that threat was always there. That's one dynamic. We don't have that anymore. All we have is these fake leaders now, like Sharpton, that come out and tell everybody, oh, well, I don't like what you're doing. Be calm. Let's be civil. Let's get things under control. That's all we have now. We don't have that other aspect of it. And not to say that Sharpton is in the tradition of Dr. King, because he is not. I'm just saying he's a capitulator, and we don't need that. We need people who are going to put stress on the system and try to change something.
But we also need something else, and that is, you know, we've given a pass to Black people to just blame it on the leaders.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the Black community has just absolutely abrogated the responsibility to protect whatever turf was gained through their vigorous involvement.
Right, exactly.
They opted out.
There's another dynamic, too, here as well. We have been taught or conditioned to be afraid of our teenagers, of our young Black men especially. And I can't tell you how many times I hear people my age and older sort of
kind of justifying this type of thing, like, you know, well, what was he out there doing and why are people, you know, they've conditioned us to be afraid of our youngsters. And when it didn't used to be like that. I mean, I grew up in the early 70s, and the neighbors, you know, I grew up in the South, but the neighbors would raise you just as well as your parents. You know, if they saw you doing something, they'd come out there and say, hey, look, you're not supposed to be doing that. I'm going to tell your parents when you get home, or either they'd handle it themselves right there. See, there's no more of that anymore either. We don't take responsibility. You know, the old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. We don't have that anymore. People just are afraid of teenagers, I think. I think they've taught us to be that way, and that's another dynamic we need to deal with. We need to deal with that as well. There's a lot of issues here that, you know, and of course part of it too is like you said a couple of days ago about gaining political power and using that power. Now, obviously, we can't rely on any of these Democrats, these fake liberal Democrats who just go along with all this nonsense. We can't do that. And what I mean about grabbing political power and taking it is giving, first of all, giving these Democrats an ultimatum. Okay? Now, I talk to people about, you know, movies like the Black Panthers, and they are under the impression that the Black Panthers, most of them were Democrats. No, they were not. They were socialists, most of them. Okay? And this is what we need to do. We need to get our own separate political, you know, power by forcing either these Democrats to really back up what they say or move on from them. Move on, stop supporting them, because like you said, every time something like this happens where we get another young black man shot down for no reason, they just shut up. They just go hide somewhere.
Well, I would put it this way. I would say they of course are saying, well, he was a suspect, a prime suspect in a strong armed robbery.
Yeah,
of a
couple
of years.
Yeah,
I'm saying this. Let's say he robbed 10 stores.
Right.
Let's go for broke on this one. He robbed 10 stores. He absolutely robbed 10
exactly,
stores.
Exactly.
It still doesn't change the fact that the conduct of the police officer here is a serious question. This is the point I'm making. When we have these kinds of discussions, we ought to see it for what it is. This is not to deny that there are elements in our community. We have contradictions, major contradictions in our community. But we're real clear about this particular instance that we're discussing. We are particularly crystal clear that the issue is the conduct of the police officer, mm-hmm. and that it resulted in the death of a person. Whatever the circumstance was prior, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, I would take it even farther, Utrecht. If he was a fleeing murder suspect and you knew at the time, he still has rights. I mean, nobody
correct.
Likes to say that, but it's true in this country.
Yes, it does.
The job of the police is to protect everyone's rights and protect property and life. That includes people who are suspected of things, by the way. That doesn't mean just because you're suspected. And we know that this cop was not, he was not suspected at the time that this cop harassed these two boys. That cop didn't have that on his mind. We know that. This is all just coming out afterwards. And
right.
and I don't care if you thought he did a murder. He still is supposed to be taken into custody, not shot.
Correct. Then that's the issue. I mean,
right.
The point is
exactly.
We shouldn't be getting sidetracked by that. The second thing is, I think we should be beyond the point of asking anything of any party. Don't ask them for anything.
Right.
Just absolutely walk away and start your own thing. Just walk
exactly.
away from it. Dump them.
Exactly. Because
don't beg them to serve you. This is not making sense to me. The idea
right.
is you walk away, you dump them. You put them,
dump.
As I say, put them out of your misery.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Just keep
I
moving.
Agree.
Keep moving.
And you know,
we need to get back to being open to different things, too. Because, you know, you say the word socialist, and people are like, that's some stuff that I don't know. And we have this, you know, especially in our communities.
And I believe that that's a legitimate, I must say, it's a legitimate criticism. Look, in the 60s, people were all transfixed about proclaiming how left they are. And frankly, it is absolutely, it is kind of irrelevant in a way. People don't want to know what it is you believe. They want to know what it is you do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is, how do you translate whatever it is you say you believe? How does it translate at ground level? We
right.
want to see, we don't care whether you're a socialist or communist or liberal, Democrat or conservative. Can you fix this problem?
Right.
You know, that's the point. So there was a lot of this romance going on about, you know, the political philosophies and so forth, as if that in and of itself was a solution.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't. We need practical application of whatever it is you believe. I couldn't care less what you want to call it. I want to see whether you have some workable solutions for the problems that exist. And
right.
can you make them real? Can you actualize them? That's
and
the
in
question.
In the end, it's about actions. You're absolutely right. In the end,
That's
it's
it.
About actions. But, you know, I'll bring up socialist candidates to people, and immediately, right away, because of the label, they'll have this
and
certain
that,
impression.
And that is to be anticipated because, I mean, if you know that this is going to create a kind of barrier, then why create it? Why
yeah,
make it
yeah.
a point to say, well, I'm a socialist? No.
Right.
Why not just simply say, I'm about solving problems?
Right.
And go ahead and deal with that and let people engage with you on that level.
But
there
see,
is this,
it,
there's
it,
this thing. It's very off-putting. And,
that,
you know, on this program, I always talk about eschewing labels because half the people who apply these labels to themselves have no clue what they really mean. If
well,
I were to ask
mean.
A Democrat what is the philosophy of the Democratic Party, they wouldn't be able to tell me. If
right.
I were to ask a nationalist what is a nationalist, they wouldn't be able to tell me. They'll tell me what they think it is, but they won't be able to tell me what it actually is. If I were to ask a libertarian what is libertarianism, they wouldn't be able to tell me. So
yeah.
you know, get away from all these labels. And this is one of the problems, too, that people begin to create, rather than remove impediments to progress, they erect them. So
right.
now I have to accept socialism if I'm going to have any kind of contact with you or cooperate with you in any venture. It's going to be, I have to deal with this thing about you're a socialist. I couldn't care less what you are. I couldn't care less what you believe. Can
I
we
agree
both agree
you,
that we've got
Utrecht,
to fix this block?
In this country, Utrecht, I agree with you totally, but in this country, we're so hung up on labels. That's the problem. It's not just the black community. Everybody is just hung
but
up
the
on
the black folks. You know, we
themselves.
The black folks do this thing in style now. Everybody's got to know what your label is.
Uh-huh.
I'm a nationalist. Half the folks who say they're nationalists are sorry examples of nationalism.
Exactly.
They have no clue what nationalism is. You know,
exactly.
They don't have a clue. They just
and
say it.
Same with Democrats and Republicans. They've gotten so far away from what a Republican conservative value is, not that I'm that, and then the Democrats are supposed to be representing the people, but they're so far from that. I mean, it's like, what do you call him a Democrat anymore? It's, you know, I just think, like you said, drop all the labels, but then when you do that, it's like they don't accept you because we have to have a label in this country.
Look,
you know what I mean?
You have a label if you think you need it, but I look at some of the most effective people who you could say, I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's program was very socialist.
Mm-hmm.
It was an extreme, it was as close as the country had ever come to the Communist Manifesto. You mean you're going to use public dollars to build public works programs and social service programs? And that's very socialist. But, you know, he was certainly not going to come out and say, I'm a socialist. But those are the programs in theory and in concept came as close as you could get to a socialist program.
But people put pressure on him, like Eugene Debs and all these other people that, you know, he had someone to the left of him that was saying, you better do this, you know. He didn't start out that way, by the way, either. He was kind of pushed into it because...
But it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't a socialist response. It was a logical response that very close in the thinking of a socialist program. It's very close. But it wouldn't have mattered to get stuck on this idea of, well, is this a socialist program or not?
Mm-hmm.
No,
mm-hmm.
It's about putting people to work, solving problems, creating things that are of service and of benefit to people. That's it.
Absolutely.
So we need to get to that point of cooperating with each other on the basis of an agreement that there are problems that we can tackle together. And I couldn't care what your political label is. I just want, or what you believe it to be, more accurately. I'm interested in whether we have a clear picture that the larger issue is in working in the service of the community. So that brings us to the end of our program, DX Today. And thank you so much. Thank everyone for their considered opinions and the best that they offered us today, and quite a bit they did offer us. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, and I do so enjoy hearing from you at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thank you so much for being with me today. And I want to encourage you, of course, to keep track of how things are unfolding, because we'll be discussing these issues. The facts still have to be assembled. They're not definitive. So they will flesh out a bit, and we'll be able to engage in a discussion more intelligently about these critical issues. But let's, for the moment, thank goodness that we came through the week. Have yourselves a very restful weekend, and we'll meet up again on Monday, God willing, and the creek don't rise. All right, so take care of yourselves. And again, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.